I learned to read him through his silences. That sounds romantic. That is not what it was. The way he disappeared for 3 days and then appeared again like weather, warm, present, asking about the things I had told him weeks ago, remembering details I had barely noticed I had shared, and the way I felt when he reappeared, the loosening of something I had not realized was clenched, the specific relief of it. That was not love. I know that now. I did not know it then. What I knew then was that the relief was real, and that the relief only existed because the silence had existed first, and that I had begun organizing my days around trying to prevent the silence rather than building a life that did not need him in it. There was a lipstick in my bathroom that I never used. I had bought it on a Tuesday in October, the color a deep rose that I thought he would like, because he had once, early on, said something about a woman in a film and the particular shade she was wearing. I did not wear it to our dinner that week. I put it in the drawer and forgot it, but I did not forget why I had bought it, and months later, when I was finally trying to understand what had happened, I found it again, still wrapped, never opened, and I understood exactly what it was. Evidence. Not of love. Of a woman who had learned to anticipate what another person wanted with a precision that she had completely lost for what she herself needed. He was not cruel in the ways the books describe. He did not shout. He did not threaten. There was never a moment I could point to and say, "This is abuse." That is the most precise way I have of describing the trap I was in. The trap had no walls I could see. It had patterns. And patterns, unlike walls, are invisible from inside. The pattern that ran everything was simple enough that I am embarrassed to describe it. When I was consistent, available, warm, and present, he withdrew. When I gave him space or pulled back or became unavailable, not strategically, not as a game, just because life demanded my attention elsewhere, he returned, more attentive than before, more specific about what he valued in me, more clearly the person I had fallen for in the first place. I did not identify the pattern. I identified only the outcomes. The outcome when I was fully available was distance. The outcome when I was preoccupied was closeness. The lesson my nervous system learned was, be less available. The next lesson it learned, this one is the one that took me longest to unlearn, was that the closeness I experienced when I pulled back was real and earned, and that my job was to manage the calibration of my availability in order to produce that closeness more consistently. I was training myself to want less of him in order to keep more of him. I was learning to suppress my own needs in order to keep a system running that was designed to work precisely because I was suppressing my needs. This is intermittent reinforcement. Psychologists identified the mechanism decades ago. B.F. Skinner demonstrated in the 1950s that when a reward is delivered on an unpredictable schedule, sometimes when you press the lever, sometimes not, with no discernible pattern, the behavior of pressing the lever becomes more persistent, more compulsive, harder to extinguish than when the reward is delivered consistently. The gambling industry built itself on this principle. So did he. He did not know he was doing it. I want to say that clearly, because the version of this story where he was consciously manipulating a schedule is a simpler and more satisfying story than the one I actually lived. The truth is more complicated. He was doing what he had always done in relationships, what had worked, in the sense that it kept women oriented toward him without requiring him to do the sustained, unglamorous work of actual partnership. It worked not because he designed it, but because it fit a pattern his nervous system had learned and kept using. Understanding that did not make it easier to leave. That is one of the things nobody tells you about intermittent reinforcement. The absence of conscious malice in the person delivering it does not reduce its effect on the person receiving it. The mechanism is the mechanism regardless of intent. The midpoint of this story is a weekend in February, when he was warm and present and specific about a future we had talked about. A trip, a plan, something that required both of us to commit to something being real. And I felt, sitting across from him, that we had finally arrived somewhere stable, that the pattern had broken, that the version of him I experienced in those hours was the version that would stay. He was gone again by the following Thursday. Not gone, he texted. but the quality of presents had retreated so far that the Thursday texts and the Sunday presents might as well have been two different people, which I slowly came to understand was functionally true. The anchor object in this story is the lipstick I did not open, not because it represents love, because it represents the moment I began organizing my desires around what he wanted rather than what I wanted. I bought the lipstick, not because I wanted to wear that color, but because I imagined him seeing it and thought the seeing would produce something in him that he was not producing on his own. That is not generosity. That is management. And the moment I began managing what he felt by calibrating what I showed him, I had lost the thread of who I was before I knew him. The exit from intermittent reinforcement is not graceful. This is another thing nobody tells you. You do not simply recognize the pattern and step away from it, with your dignity intact and a clear-eyed understanding of what happened. You recognize the pattern, and then, for a period that was, in my case, longer than I am comfortable admitting, you continue pressing the lever because your nervous system has been trained. The recognition does not immediately reprogram the training. The knowledge of the mechanism and the felt urgency of the mechanism coexist for an uncomfortable amount of time, and what you experience in that period is the specific torture of understanding exactly what is happening to you and not being able to stop responding to it. What finally changed was not an insight. It was a cost. The cost was this. I missed a professional opportunity in March, a real one, with a real timeline that required me to be fully present for 3 weeks, because I could not stop monitoring the pattern, could not stop checking whether he was warm or cold, available or withdrawn, because the state of the pattern had become the primary information I was using to navigate my own days. The opportunity closed, someone else took it, and I sat with the understanding that I had sacrificed something concrete and mine for the maintenance of a system that had never been organized around my well-being. That was the cost that was real enough to operate on. Not the insight, the cost, the practical consequence of staying, the one that my logic had always minimized because it did not feel as urgent as the felt urgency of the pattern, was that I was not building what I needed to build. Every month I spent calibrating my availability to manage his attention was a month I was not using my attention for the things that would outlast him. And those things, the work, the friendships that had quieted because I was managing instead of living, the version of myself that I had been before the lever, those things do not wait indefinitely. I kept the lipstick in the drawer for 11 months. When I finally threw it away, still wrapped, I noticed that I felt almost nothing. That felt like the right ending. Almost nothing, it turns out, is an enormous improvement over the specific ache of waiting for a pattern to finally break in your favor. The question I want to leave with you is this. When you look at the lever you have been pressing, the relationship, the dynamic, the system you keep trying to calibrate, how long has the schedule been unpredictable? And when did you last ask yourself what the pressing has cost you that you cannot get back?